Welcome to episode 7 of the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
And John.
Here we are. Well, I'll tell you what, guys, I've had a big week. I got to go down to CUNA and get a new kitchen table, so I've really been traveling the world here.
You ventured all the way out to CUNA?
Yeah, it was pretty exciting down there in CUNA.
Did you like go cow tipping while you were in CUNA? Like, was it just a table and back?
I actually drove past the Linder Farms, which I hadn't seen, and that is a happening place. There were like probably
the pumpkin
hundreds,
patch slash...
hundreds of cars out there.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. So CUNA, I mean, let me tell you.
But why were you getting a new table? I'm trying to figure out how this is a story.
Well,
are you trying to say that your life is boring?
Well, it's not like that exciting, I guess.
Pedestrian.
The table, you know, it's pretty nice. We were kind of running out of room with our old table, and now we have a big table. It's like 7.5 feet, and we can fit everybody around it, and it's pretty exciting.
I don't have much more excitement than that. We went to Chalice and almost hit a couple elk on the way up.
Well, that is exciting. That's better than cow tipping.
Yeah, yeah. And we got to see snow. We got to drive through snow for the first time this year. So all the kids were like, "Dad, are we going to die?" It's like, you know, a quarter of an inch of snow on the ground.
It was cold last weekend.
It was. But I think Amanda went a lot further away than Chalice. 4-hour drive versus...
Well, you know, about 8-9 hours on an airplane.
Where did you go, Amanda?
Well, a lot of places, and don't get me started because I'll talk all night, but yeah, Rome, Florence, Paris, and London.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
Why are you groaning in the background?
Because it sounds pretty fantastic, and I'm a little bit jealous.
So there were no cows to tip. No elk to run into.
Okay, so give us the highlights, because we can't do it all. So give us the top 3 things that come to mind from your trip.
I stood in the Colosseum, in the Sistine Chapel, and Westminster Abbey. And that's a few highlights, but I also went to the top of the Eiffel Tower, floated down the Seine River, and saw quite a handful of the highlights of Western art. So I don't know. I don't even know if I can talk about it. I stood in front of original Botticelli's. I actually wept. Conversion of St. Paul in a tiny little church near the gates of Rome.
Botticelli. Is Botticelli the guy that we listened to the podcast with here recently, David?
The Conversion of St. Paul. I'm pulling this guy.
Botticelli.
Up here. Woo! No, that's
yeah.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. So there's this tiny little church. It's not particularly famous or anything, and they have 2 original Botticellis. Conversion of St. Paul, and opposite it is the Crucifixion of Peter. And
I know that piece. Yeah.
Yeah. Just absolutely moving. And I mean, I don't know. It's cliche to say it, but it's so different in person. Then, I mean, you've seen the images your whole life. You see them in books. You can pull anything up on the web. But they're just so moving in person.
So like what goes through your mind? You're standing in the Colosseum.
Is that the one by Caravaggio? Crucifixion of St. Peter?
No. The Crucifixion of St. Peter was also a Botticelli, although I saw a lot of Caravaggio's also. And Artemisia Gentileschi's Judith and Holofernes.
Yes.
That bloody one where she's cutting his head off.
Cutting
Bernini
that off, yep.
Sculptures, original Bernini's in the Borgia mansion,
wasn't
which is now
Judith
an art museum.
In response to, like, she had been accused of sexual misconduct or something like that.
Well, she'd been sexually assaulted.
That's right. Yeah.
They tried to force her into a marriage with a much older man,
and
she refused, and he assaulted her,
right.
And she fled.
Right.
And so the story is that painting was a response to that.
Right.
Her take on the Judith story, and really there are many paintings of that scene. And it's widely considered the most moving. And it was actually mistakenly attributed to Caravaggio
for
years.
That is a horrifying image.
So.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic story. It's been a while since I've brushed up on it, but it's, yeah.
Right. Well, we're Protestants, so, you know, we don't read Judith very often, but.
Well, not the Judith story so much as her story.
Artemisia.
I can't say her name, but yeah, her story and how she was framed for supposed sexual misconduct herself or whatever. And she
was, there was a
she
trial.
Was put on trial.
She was.
And they had some crazy test to test her virginity or something. I mean, it's a bizarre story. It very much feels like the Dark Ages when you read the story. You're like, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the Dark Ages. It's the late, middle, early, modern period.
Really?
Renaissance. Yeah. But yeah, it definitely feels, of course, when it comes to those kinds of issues, it's surprising how recent the Dark Ages can feel.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So.
Yep. Yep. I sent you guys a link about that here just recently. So maybe we'll get to that tonight. I don't know.
Maybe so.
So you're standing in the Colosseum and you think to yourself, what?
I'm standing in the Colosseum. It's here. And it's, you know, it's huge. It's impressive. And you can feel the age. Of course, the Colosseum, more properly called the Flavian Amphitheater, was not very carefully preserved. It was, ravaged for building materials. But what's left there is still quite impressive. And it's really interesting to walk around it and just think about the tens of thousands of Romans in there watching sport, right in the spot where the emperors used to sit. Of course, later Christians erected a cross, which is preserved. There's a cross right there where, in the emperor's seat. We left the Colosseum, then walked across, the Roman Forum, stood on the top of Capitoline Hill where Rome was founded. Amazing. Amazing to be there. So those were all highlight. Oh, the Pantheon. Mm-hmm. I don't know how familiar you are with the Pantheon, that, you know, round temple, to all the gods of Rome that was, of course, later converted into a church and so has many paintings, frescoes, statues in it. It's an incredibly impressive building, huge. And when you think, of course, when it was built, everybody lives in a mud hut or a small stone house. And it's still, the pillars are so tall, it is still impressive to stand under it.
Did you feel like the students, because you were there with high school students, seniors, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So did you feel like the students were able to appreciate and feel the grandeur and be just blown away, or were they just kind of kids?
I couldn't talk about them as an entire group and say they responded as a group in a particular way, but there were certainly students who appreciated, both the history and the beauty that we,
You're fine. So I don't know why you couldn't talk about them as a group. We like to overgeneralize and just make broad sweeping statements.
There's definitely one kid on the trip that seemed much more interested in the shopping available in Europe. bought a pair of white leather tennis shoes for 650 euros, which is a little surprising how exciting that was to him and his classmates, but certainly a large number of students that were very impressed by the things that we saw, you know, because we saw all the highlights, not the original David. That museum was sold out for the day, so we couldn't get in to see
Michelangelo's David, right.
But the replica that stands in the spot where the David originally stood, we were able to see that. Mona Lisa, of course, in the Louvre, and I don't know, Venus de Milo, Winged Victory.
Okay, we got to stop her. She's going to just keep on doing this all night.
All night long.
She's gonna
Did it just give you shivers to stand
I, I'm
in
not even joking.
Spots.
I wept more than once because it was so incredible. I mean, Capitoline Hill, St. Paul stood there, right? Like, what else?
It was a while ago, but it was right there.
It was right there. Right there.
That's really cool.
I can imagine that's kind of.
So, David, let's hear some comparison between CUNA and.
Well, so I went down to this Tegucigalpa table is just fantastic.
Actually, going to try to do this.
No, this was great. I went to go get the table, and the lady comes to the door, and I'm like going to pick it up. I have the truck. I'm going to pick it up, and the lady comes to the door in a full Wonder Woman outfit.
She's leaving
in a couple of minutes to go to a costume party.
No way. Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Did that make you weep?
Almost.
That's great.
So you go, you come back. And
I go and I come back.
You think to yourself, America is amazing. I am so glad
well,
to be home.
Well, gotta say, easy access to bathrooms, not to be underestimated. Europeans don't make a priority of public restrooms.
Okay.
So right. when there are public restrooms, which is not often, you have
them.
To pay to use them.
Right.
Which we all know. But also, water is not freely available. You have to buy it. Uh-huh. No water fountains, or few. They're available, but very few. So I wonder if all of Europe has a headache from being dehydrated. I don't know.
They just drink wine.
They just drink wine.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the ready availability of that is, yeah, sure. you know, nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
Gotta say the most, frustrating thing coming back is just the contrast in the buildings. And obviously I was going to, you know, the ancient parts of the cities
right.
and seeing the best bits. But, even in our city, a nice little town, our buildings are not highly decorated, and building after building after building is just gorgeous. The details, the considered details of the architecture. And because all of our buildings are so youthful, and because our age is not one that places a priority on beauty in architecture, or the beauty that we prioritize is simplicity and clean lines.
Beauty as well, I would say.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
you have the weird aesthetic that you see at the village where you have this fake age. It's right. made to look like it's weathered, which is very odd.
Right. That sense of a movie set, that this has been constructed and it's very much a setting. And hasn't grown up naturally. And I mean, I can't complain that my city's not old. I mean, it wasn't settled.
Just go to the Olive Garden more often and yeah, you're good to go.
I got to go to the Olive Garden more often. Clearly, that's the takeaway here. Yeah. So
good
times.
Home
I come home and...
And you're settled and you're not planning any trips to Chalice or Kuna in the near future.
Not in the near future. I think I'd like to stay home for a while. It is a little bit of a shock to come home after being pretty disconnected for a couple of weeks and get the flood of news that happened while I was gone.
So yeah, like what I'm trying to think what happened. Trump is doing all kinds of crazy stuff with Puerto Rico. Can't
That's
figure
pretty
out what he's doing there.
Par for the course, it seems. The biggest
Harvey
news, Harvey Weinstein was
Weinstein.
The biggest news
yep.
story. Of course, Las Vegas happened while, the
right.
night before we left.
You know,
so we missed a lot of the commentary on that. But then, yeah, the biggest, most shocking thing coming back was the Harvey Weinstein, news stories. Shocking, just the size of the news stories. Like when I was talking to my husband, shocking, a man in power, victimized, vulnerable young women. I'm going to faint. I'm so surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. At some level, it's not. Well, I had my own experience this week. So I got to run this past you guys because this is so bizarre. But so in the wake of all of this going on, I had the weirdest thing happen. So on Monday, I do home inspections, for work. And at the end of a home inspection that I was doing, the realtor, for the home inspection, showed up and we were having a conversation. And in the course of this conversation, the realtor who was female and older than me, 25 to 35 years older than me, I was taking pictures at the end of the inspection and she came up and slapped me in the butt.
Oh my.
And it wasn't, I don't know. It wasn't an accident and it wasn't like end of the world. Like I felt like my whole face turned, but it was just happened so fast. I was like, what?
Was it like on a sports team when you're walking off the field and you slap, like
no. And it wasn't like I felt like I'd been fondled or something like that. It was somewhere in between those two, but it wasn't an accident. Like it wasn't.
So
and I went, okay.
So did you post Me Too on Facebook?
No, I didn't post Me Too on Facebook. No, I didn't. But honestly, it all the client showed up just minutes after that happened, and so I'm doing a review with the client and everything. And I'm sitting at the end of the day, and I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, if this had happened, and it had been a 30-something-year-old female, and a late 60s, early 70s year, you know, man had come up and done the same thing, we would be pressing charges. And
reasonably enough.
And maybe it was, you know, I'm not even for a moment considering that, but it was a bizarre experience. And so suddenly through my head, I started thinking, like, all these thoughts start running through my head, which I've heard women say these things before.
Right.
Like, was I doing something that invited that act? Like, what did I say that made that appropriate in that person's mind? And what in the world could I have done differently? Should I have said something to them, like, immediately? I mean, hey, that's inappropriate. Or
you get confrontational? Do you not get confrontational?
Exactly.
What are the consequences of one or the other?
Right, exactly.
Like, what happens if that was innocent and I, like, it was innocently meant, but I took it.
Exactly, exactly.
Like, how, it's an incredibly complicated, like,
right.
The calculus in your head.
And I mean, for the record, I've lost exactly zero sleep over the experience. But the next day, kid you not, I'm doing a review with a different client, and I come inside, and I've got, I thought I had brushed off all of my insulation off of my shirt, and I walk inside and look behind me, and I've got insulation, like, trailing in behind me, and I'm like, oh, man, I should have shook my shirt out before I came inside. And female client says to me, I wish I would have been there.
Oh, my.
What?
You're on a roll, John.
So
now here we have to ask you, John, what were you wearing?
What was I was wearing Carhartt pants. I was wearing keen-soled boots, and I was wearing a knit polo that had my name on it.
So I got to tell you,
I don't,
you know,
believe
women,
my
fine Carhartt pants
crack was showing at the time of the inspection.
Oh, man. Oh. So the accumulation of those two incidents.
Yes.
That's an interesting, I don't know, the timing is interesting.
Yeah. So apparently I was putting off some kind of a vibe or something.
It never rains, but it pours, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, shouldn't you be grateful for the attention at your time of life?
At my time of life, as with my level of hair loss.
With your level of hair loss.
No,
yeah. In all seriousness.
Well, in all seriousness, like, I don't care. Like, for me, it's not. And honestly, it's different. It's not apples to apples between with a man and a woman, because I'm not there. There's no way that either situation was I ever in danger.
Right.
There's no situation where I honestly I wasn't even uncomfortable. Like, it was. It just happened. But it was for the very first time in my life. I was actually in a somewhat back-to-back awkward situations where I just was like, oh, well, this would suck if I were a girl. If the roles were
well, and I think that the fundamental difference, at least in my mind, is your relative vulnerability, right? Like,
Right. I have very limited vulnerability.
Right.
Right.
And you don't live in the world and approach the world as somebody who's weaker than more than 50%
of
the
population.
Yeah,
the only vulnerability I would say that you have in that situation is if you did accuse a person. So
right.
If I were to respond to
right.
either one of those situations, the flip side could be played, because it's just two people there, right?
Right.
So if I say, hey, that was inappropriate.
Right.
The Potiphar's wife thing.
Exactly. There you go. Yeah.
And who's more likely to be believed in those situations,
right,
in our society?
Carhartts or the reputable business person?
Right.
Right. Right. So, and honestly, we've now completely thought about this more than I thought about it all week long. but I know that happens, like, every single day in every single restaurant here in town, where little snide remarks get made to servers and girls get grabbed, and it's a reality.
Well, I mean, you kind of joked about the whole Me Too thing, and I think that that's a appropriate joke in the moment, but like I don't think I did on Facebook, but I think I posted Me Too on Twitter. And the interesting thing to me about the thought process of whether I chime in or not was, well, none of the situations I dealt with were that bad, right? Like, the you know, dismissing the severity of it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I thought about was the one time I was grabbed, because, you know, you said girls in restaurants, right? Like I worked in a restaurant and some guy, just,
what kind of a restaurant was it?
It was an upscale fancy restaurant.
What were you wearing?
I was wearing a long black skirt.
See, that's your problem right
there. Right there. It may have been slightly form-fitting. I'm not sure. We can determine my level of guilt later. So some old, some creepy old guy walked by. He went from his table where he had just received his food to go to the restroom, and he just grabbed my butt as he walked by.
Right.
Like,
right.
I have no idea what could have possibly been going through his head. And I did that whole thing questioning. Did that just happen?
Yeah.
What, did I imagine that?
Right.
Told my manager. My manager threw him out.
Oh, that's so cool.
Right.
What a wonderful situation.
Love it. Remember that moment as the moment my manager and the waiter united together, threw the guy out. Here's the thing. I just realized I have totally suppressed the memory of how the entire time I worked there, my manager, every waiter I worked with, every busboy I worked with, because I was the only girl in the whole place, every cook I worked with, deliberately harassed me day in, day out, every night. But what do I remember? The time they stuck up for me.
The one time they stood up for you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The specials board.
Right.
The whiteboard next to the register in the back of the restaurant. Right? Right in front of me where I do all of my work in the back of the restaurant. Mm. You know what was drawn on it all night. Every night. Mm. Every time I erased it, somebody came back to try their artistic skills. Mm-hmm. You know, 18 years old, innocent, homeschool girl, mm-hmm. had never seen one in real life, mm-hmm. saw lots of cartoonish drawings. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd bend down to get something underneath the register. Mm-hmm. And one of the waiters would say, well, while you're down there.
Right.
Didn't even know what it meant the first 1,700 times they said it.
Right.
But what do I remember and what do I tell people about? My manager and the waiter stuck up for me.
Mm-hmm. The time that it...
They harassed me constantly.
Boy, this has been a cheerful conversation. That sounds a lot worse than what I went through.
Well, not to belittle your experiences, John.
Thanks. I think I'll retract my Me Too hashtag now.
You know, and in actual seriousness, I know you're just joking here, but in actual seriousness, the thing is, I feel like my experiences weren't that bad.
Right.
Because I can name every woman I know that I have a close enough relationship with to have had a serious conversation, or pretty much every woman has been groped or attacked.
Right. Right.
And I know dozens of women who have been raped. Mm-hmm. Violently. Mm-hmm. I know dozens of women who have been drugged. And I don't have that wide of a circle of friends. Mm-hmm. So I belittle my own experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, stupid punk kids were drawing, you know, male anatomy on a whiteboard. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was frustrating and annoying. And I found that experience
demeaning.
A hostile work environment. yes, demeaning. Mm-hmm. But I've never been attacked, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So mine doesn't really count. It's not that bad. Mm-hmm. I've been catcalled mm-hmm. a lot, mm-hmm. but you know, that's not that bad. Mm-hmm. I've actually been genuinely scared mm-hmm. a lot, but nothing ever came of it. So I'm probably just a fraidy cat and it's, yeah, mine's not that bad. Mm-hmm. Not compared to, and
we live in such a horrifying world, and it's just so overwhelmingly horrifying to mm-hmm. see the sin and the ugliness that is just around and affects so many people.
Yeah.
And in this, disproportionately women. Absolutely.
Well, this particular sin,
yeah.
I think we see it that way. Although I have read some interesting statistics, that say that, that paint a more complex picture. Because if there's anything that's socially unacceptable in our society, it's for a man to report a sexual assault. Our society is very hostile to the idea that a man can be raped, especially by a woman. And the actual sexual assaults that go on constantly in our prisons are the fodder of jokes widely in our society.
Well, yeah, but yeah. I think also though, in context, like historically, it's way worse.
Oh yeah.
it's, and at least culturally speaking, people can step back and go and frown on it and recognize that it's
right.
That it's more than just demeaning, but sick or, you know, immoral. Like, we can figure out lots of words. And this is pretty much a bipartisan thing. Like, you don't have to be liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, you know, American.
Christian, secular.
Right. British.
It's wrong. It's wrong. Wrong because it's wrong.
It's wrong. It's wrong. Like,
even people who don't believe in absolute truth would agree that it's wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, historically, I think that that's the one thing we do have to keep in perspective, not denying the severity of the problem that we have in our culture, but keeping that in perspective. I mean, I'm talking about words and pictures and groping that's happened in my life. But as a history teacher, I have to teach about, you know, war in the ancient
the rape
world.
Of Nanking.
Right. That. Right. Yeah. Well, I don't.
You may not teach that.
I don't teach that.
What's something you teach? Greek history?
Well, I teach Greek and Roman history.
There you go. So you pick your.
What happens when an army conquers a city? All the women in the conquered city are carried off as slaves and or immediately raped.
I would say.
Right.
And or.
And then.
And.
And. Yes. Yeah. You know, the Iliad. Wonderful, beautiful, epic poem centers on the rape of multiple women, right? Why is Achilles throwing a fit? Because Agamemnon stole his comfort woman. What's a comfort woman? A captured woman that is now your sex slave. This episode, not safe for children.
We'll have to put a tag on it.
Explicit content included. All right.
I was I've been listening to this series on the Spanish conquest of the Aztecs, and the whole thing is about rape. The Mexica, the whole thing is about rape.
Yeah,
I mean, they were there to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ and rape as many women as they could, and get gold. And those three apparently
maybe in that order.
Yeah, went along great, I guess.
In their minds.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, our national history has some pretty dark episodes in it.
I don't want to talk about it now, though.
Are you too depressed?
I'm too depressed. I sent David and Mary, David and Amanda, not Mary Beth, but David and Amanda, a story this week about something I didn't know about. And I honestly, I don't know that I want to talk about it. We've talked about this enough. It's pretty dark and dismal. And if you want to look it up yourself, there's a just Wikipedia, Celia versus the state of Missouri. And it's pretty, pretty tragic stuff. And, David, you can read it later.
Yeah. I'll have to read it
to your kids as bedtime.
Oh man.
Bedtime reading material.
Alrighty. Well, let's mix things up a little bit here. Try to change our, direction here a little bit. We thought it would be really fun to try something a little different. And, John is a pastor. Maybe some of you knew, some of you didn't know. John is, he preaches, not every week, but every few weeks he'll preach a sermon. Right now he's going through the book of Revelation, and we thought it'd be pretty fun to have him go through his sermon, and we will talk about it and see.
Tell him what he can say and not say.
Exactly. Okay. We'll do the critique.
You're doing the critique. So I don't know how this is going to work. So we'll play this by
ear. Let's wing it.
Okay, here we go. So I'm preaching on Revelation 21. We don't have time to go through the whole passage of scripture, but Revelation 21, the New Jerusalem. So I don't even know where to go.
A new heaven and a new earth. All things made new.
Yeah, that was last week. New heaven and new earth was last week.
New Jerusalem, the bride of the Lamb.
The bride of Christ.
That's verse 9.
So you have 9 through the end of the chapter. My plan is to start with an introduction to the introduction, because that's always a good idea, to introduce your thing multiple times. And one of the problems I've run into with this passage is there are so many different ideas of what's going on in Revelation, and specifically with New Jerusalem. There's a lot of controversy with New Jerusalem itself. And it's kind of along the same lines as the debate that you see oftentimes between those who take a free will emphasis in Scripture versus people who take a sovereignty of God emphasis on Scripture. And I believe that you see both of those elements in Scripture. And that when we get to heaven, God is not going to walk up to some reformed pastor and say, you got it right, man. You got it all 100% right. Or he's going to walk up to some Arminian pastor and say, you nailed it. There's going to be aspects. We as Christians, the Bible seems to live comfortably in the tension between the ideas of free will and sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so
this is why we're such good friends. Totally agree.
Okay, cool. So I'm off to a good start.
You're off to a good start.
I'm off to a good start.
If your congregation was me, which it's not.
Okay, so. Well, my suspicion is our congregation is probably like a lot of congregations. So there are congregations that are explicitly Reformed, and there are congregations that are explicitly Arminian. But for the most part, congregations are a pretty blended bunch. And then when we get into Revelation, people are even more blended than that. Like, so there's like, you could roughly break schools of thought for Revelation into maybe three or four main groups. And the problem with that is that,
can we break out those groups?
I don't know if I'm qualified to break them out well, but the current most popular ideology would be called premillennial dispensational. So that is your Tim LaHaye and your Jerry B. Jenkins and the whole Left Behind series. Some people believe that stuff very literally. Some people would say they are dispensational, but that is a caricature of what is true dispensationalism. So it's not maybe a fair comparison, but that would be the person who's highly regarded. And then you on the opposite extreme of the biblical interpretation would be I'm blanking. What are they called? Amillennial. And amillennial tends to be more of the historical reformed position on how to interpret Revelation. And then realize too, like when I say historical reform position, like Luther and Calvin were both like, we don't know what the heck is going on in this book. It's not even, was it Luther or Calvin who wasn't sure it should be even canonized? It should have been canonized.
I think it was Luther wasn't sure that it should have been canonized, and Calvin, also wasn't sure, because when canonization happened, it was the most hotly contested.
Right.
Do we include it or not?
Right.
This is iffy.
Right. So the amillennial view takes, dispensational view takes a very literal approach. The amillennial view takes a more symbolic approach. And what I'm going to attempt in my sermon is dangerous because, there's a story. I don't know if this is true or not, but there's a story, from the Civil War that some guy was trying to bring peace to the brothers. And so he walks out in the middle of a battlefield and he's got the Confederate grays on bottom and the Union blues on top. And he's trying to bring unity and say, stop killing each other, brothers. And so
and how'd that work out for him?
Yeah. So the Union shot at his bottom and the Confederate shot at his top. And so at some level, I'm going to try to attempt that with my sermon on Sunday. So, so that's the introduction to the introduction.
Are you going to actually, introduce it that way?
Pretty much.
Great. To kind of give you some cover from the actual fire.
The actual firing. Yeah. So, yeah. So if you're, dispensational, then shoot at my bottom. And, never mind. So there's got to be a joke there about my bottom, but never mind.
Tying back into earlier
tying back
parts
into
of
the
earlier
podcast. Conversation. That's right. So the interesting thing about this whole passage, so new heavens and new earth, I take a very literal approach to new heavens and new earth. I think we're going to have we will see, God will create a literal new heaven and a literal new earth. Like we will have physically new bodies, and we will live on a physical new planet or for lack of a better word, you know, physical place. However, I think verses 9 through the end of the chapter are very symbolic. And I base that largely on the fact that that is exactly what the verse tells us in 9 through 11. So for example, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So who is the wife of the Lamb?
The church.
That, you're awfully quick on that. Why do you say that?
Because isn't that what's always been the bride of the Lamb is the church?
I don't know. What do you think, Mandy?
I think that's Christian dogma.
You think it's Christian dogma? Why do you think that? Why can't we, what?
What do you mean, why do I think that?
Okay, well.
So, church is the bride of Christ.
Church is the bride of Christ.
Yeah.
Isn't the church the bride of Christ?
I've taught that my entire life.
Okay. Are you saying the church isn't the bride of Christ?
So does the Bible actually say that anywhere?
I can't cite it.
Okay. So this is, this is the point of contention.
I have never heard this being contested.
Okay.
Now I'm really curious.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm going to go into the contention too much, but there is plenty implied that the church is the bride of Christ.
Right.
So, for example, in Ephesians, when Jesus, when the husband and wife are told to interact,
right,
like
as Christ
Jesus
loved the church
and
gave
the church,
up for, yeah,
but it doesn't actually use the word bride.
No,
it uses
it
the word church. So,
right.
But there's plenty of other, that Jesus is constantly being referred to as the bridegroom,
right,
throughout scripture. And,
yeah. So I don't know why I was so puzzled for a second there. That was really on the spot. You know, all of Old Testament history and God's relationship to Israel is, portrayed repeatedly in that language.
Mm-hmm. I think you thought it was a trick.
I did. Well, of course it's a trick.
If I'm
John's
if
looking
if
at
I'm
me
involved,
like,
then it must be a
yes,
trick. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That,
no. Also that look on your face, like, let me stump you.
Let me stump you. I'm not trying to stump you. I'm trying to. So, but there are folks who say, well, it says right here that New Jerusalem is the bride of Christ, but they are so stuck on a literal interpretation of the New Jerusalem that this has to be a new city, that this has to be a physical new recreation of the place Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
That they adamantly maintain that the bride of Christ is a city called Jerusalem.
And not that this is a symbolic representation
of everything
the
else.
The church, capital C, spread out through time and space.
Correct. So you have to you have to agree with the premise that the bride of Christ is the church, which is what I think is scripturally,
right.
Pretty
heavily.
We can probably agree on that.
Okay, so my basic statement is this: New Jerusalem is the bride of Christ. The bride of Christ has also been understood for most of the Christian tradition to be the church. Therefore, New Jerusalem, according to verses 9 and 10, is a symbol representing the complete and unblemished church. Now, here's what's fun about that. Ever heard that heaven's going to have pearly gates?
Oh, yeah.
Well, first of all, that's wrong. It's not heaven. It's the New Jerusalem.
Right.
But if we're saying that New Jerusalem is a symbol of the church, big C, no pearly gates. Ever heard that the streets of heaven are going to be paved with gold?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that comes out of Revelation 21.
Yeah.
So, first of all, wrong. It's not heaven. It's New Jerusalem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So all those hymns that you sang as a kid about when I get to heaven, I'm going to be through pearly gates ain't right. It's not, even if you believe in a literal interpretation of the New Jerusalem.
Right. It's
New Jerusalem,
on
not
the new
heaven.
Earth,
right.
Not
it's New Jerusalem. Right. So there's all. So it messes with our ideas of what heaven's going to be like. It messes with our ideas of what. With all's going on.
Pretty sure my idea of heaven has been more informed by C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce than by hymns about pearly gates.
Or The Last Battle.
Right. Yeah. Further up and further in.
Uh-huh.
But that just shows what a special kind of heretic
and
I am.
And here we
I
are again, ladies and gentlemen, episode 7. C.S. Lewis took 40 minutes to get to, but we have made our
token. We're 7-0.
7-0. So.
Have I cited Pride and Prejudice yet? On the podcast.
I
because my students just wait for me to start quoting Pride and Prejudice to them. Yes, I do teach ancient history, but Pride and Prejudice is surprisingly relevant to all of ancient history.
Completely.
And now John's puzzled.
I'm trying to draw the parallels. I was trying to make a joke, but it wasn't funny because the earlier conversation about ancient history is not funny at all.
No, not even remotely.
There's not really an appropriate joke. Okay.
Or even a funny joke.
So from that, I don't know that we need to dwell on a whole lot more in my sermon, because from there, I then go on to say there's three things that I think we can take from this, and that's the church is a complete entity, the prophetic elements being drawn from the Old Testament through the New Testament, and then we see being brought to completion in this passage, and then the radical intimacy between the bride and the bridegroom, where at the end of this passage, you're seeing things like there's no temple because there doesn't need to be one because Jesus is there. And who else is there? Christ. And have you ever noticed when we use the word intimacy in polite society, this whole conversation is going to be explicit. David, put the E next to this one. But have you ever noticed in polite society that when we say intimacy, it's like the nice way of talking about sex?
Yeah. I mean, we're always euphemistic.
There is a reason why when people talk about Revelation and Jesus coming back, it is the term that is often used is consummation. Because of the radical intimacy that's going to take place at the end. Because now all of these barriers and layers have been stripped back, and we have complete access to Christ, and Christ has complete access to us. And so that's a radical thing. We actually see that played out at the end of this passage, where now there's no temple, and now there's no, I can't remember. I don't have the Bible open in front of me right now.
It says, I did not see a temple in the city because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city doesn't need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light and the Lamb is its lamp.
Isn't that poetic? Mm-hmm. Don't you feel like that's like right out of like some cheesy youth novel or something like that? Like it's like, I don't even have to eat. My food is my love for my significant other or something like that. And that's the kind
of love for the beloved.
The love for the beloved, right?
Is the food.
Yep.
Well, so I think this ties the conversation together in a very interesting way in my head. But you said, you know, we use intimacy as a euphemism for sex. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's very explicit in the New Testament that the relationship between a Christian husband and Christian wife is supposed to be a picture of the relationship between Christ and the church.
Right.
And we say that a lot, but I don't know how much we talk about the implications of that idea, at least not in polite society, because of course we're uncomfortable with, appropriately enough, with private things being public. But the theology of that, I think, is incredibly important to understand, because when we have conversations in our homes with our children about their developing, their growing, when we have conversations with each other about each other being, you know, between spouses about our relationship, overshadowing all of those conversations about sex, about intimacy, about the solidity of a relationship, about the longevity of a marriage, about the purpose of a marriage, about the difficulties and the challenges or the joys in a marriage, overshadowing all of that for me as a Christian is this picture of the relationship between Christ and the church, and that picture of that ultimate consummation where intimacy is no longer terrifying, because intimacy as in revealing oneself to another is terrifying here on earth. Because of our sinful and flawed nature.
It's so dangerous.
It is. And we've seen in our conversation what is so dangerous, because here in this sinful world, intimacy is twisted constantly. It's used to abuse people. It's used for selfishness. It's cruel so often. And, I think I've been taught this. I know I think this, and I can't tell you all the streams that this thought has come from, but my entire picture of my marriage is on that foundation. Like everything that we do everything that we try to do, all of the difficulties that we encounter are constantly informed by this.
So going back to what you were saying about the marriage, the relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, is to be a picture of Christ in the church. So why is it important that we've tried to talk about this before and it failed epically. So let's not, if we cannot get lost in the Thule's here, but the reason that you and I have talked about the importance of partaking in communion on a weekly basis is because
that intimacy, that approach to God is
that action itself.
Yeah.
The action itself is it's a practice. It's a reminder. It is cementing
the intimacy of the relationship and feeding, sustaining the relationship.
But it is a microcosm of the bigger picture that we're trying to ultimately hope and strive towards, which is Christ in the church.
In much the same way that sex between a husband and a wife is a microcosm of the relationship.
Bingo.
Yeah.
Bingo. So that is the cool thing. That's the radical thing at the end of Revelation 21. And the reason I think this is important, and this is what will get me shot at by people who are dispensational, is because I think folks where folks can get it wrong when they're too tied up in the literal translation of this whole passage is they're getting caught up in the beauty of this physical place, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of emphasis in Christ in history outside of like the tabernacle and then the temple of God putting emphasis on a building.
Right.
And here's a place where for the very first time, it's very clear we have no temple. And yet folks who are interpreting it literally are getting all hung up on the beautiful
pearly gates and golden streets.
And what we really should be getting hung up on is the consummation.
Right. So not so much verses 15 through 21, where it's talking about the gates and all the different, the
carnelian and
how thick it is and all the, yeah.
Right.
We should be focusing on 22 through the end where it's talking about.
Well, I don't know if we shouldn't be focusing on the jasper and the carnelian.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
But
that.
We should be interpreting them symbolically. Much like the tabernacle had all of the elements of the tabernacle were symbolic for the Jewish people of their relationship with God, of significant aspects of their relationship with God. Each of those stones had meaning. Each of those figures had meaning.
Right. I think the emphasis of those verses, they're building a picture of a beautiful place. And if we would, in our culture, the context would be bride. If you just say bride, we can get gaudy real quick. We can spend, what's the average wedding going for now? 20, 30, 40, 50 grand. So it's really easy to spend a small fortune on a wedding. And so when you read this, it feels a little gaudy. Like, really? Would you want to build a city with all these like precious jewels jammed into the foundation like that? But I think it's intentionally over the top in the same way that weddings are kind of intentionally over the top.
Right.
Because what we're trying to do is highlight the bride. The bride is the point of the whole thing. But to get there, you will spare no expense. And I think that's the point of those verses. So I don't think we ignore them.
It also actually says that the walls are 200 feet thick.
So here's
that it's 1,400 miles high.
So you want to know how big that is?
Huge.
And we've made a Trump reference. We've done it, folks.
Huge. Also, seven for seven.
When I was in Rome the other day, I wasn't 1,400 miles away from you.
Oh, I got my song. I've got my random song of the week. Keep going.
So 1,400 miles is, it's like from here to the West Coast, right?
Wait, what?
1,400 miles.
The long way around.
Yeah, that's roughly how about
1,400 miles.
Yeah, 1,400 miles.
Oh, okay. I was thinking 14,000. I'm sorry. I'm tired.
1,400.
Yes, 1,400. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yes, you're right.
So 1,400. Okay, so about from here to the coast. So it's...
Or a little further. Yeah.
A little further. So we'll just say from...
It's the size of the moon.
Oh.
If you take that cube...
Wow.
If you take the cube, that is described. So it's supposed to be as deep and as high and as wide as, you know, 1400 stadia. It is the size. It's actually a little bit larger than the moon.
So if, I mean, if that's something that is supposed to be able to house, let's say, all the saints,
right?
I could kind of get that. Okay. I could kind of buy that. I don't get the tall thing. I don't get that it's 1400.
Well, think ancient culture.
Miles tall.
And the significance of high walls.
Is it just being kind of very
hyperbolic?
That's the word I'm looking for. I knew you'd have it for me.
That's my thing, I guess.
So, and if you interpret it literally, then you get into trouble because you can't, it's hard to imagine a city that's actually a cube. And so then the literal folks say, well, it's not a cube, it's a pyramid. But it says it's a cube! And you're trying to do it literally. Come on, which way do you want it, man?
I guess it could be a pyramid. Yeah,
no, it doesn't say that. If you're going to interpret it literally, be literal.
I'd never actually heard the
it's
pyramid.
It's the Borg
thing.
Cube.
That's a fun idea.
I do think, the imagery of the city, made out of precious metals and precious stones, contrasted with the real physical cities that we live in, you know, with their base materials and their deficiencies and weaknesses, and thinking about that as a symbolic contrast between our frail, sinful human marriages and the glorious consummation of the relationship between Christ and the church. The over-the-topness of the description works for me in that context.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the point of it.
Yeah.
So, and I think the other thing that like coming all the way back to the beginning, one of the things I don't want to do with the sermon is come across like it's symbolic or nothing.
Right.
One of the things
get shot at.
Well, it can it's be not both. Even get shot at because like one of the things I read this week, I was this guy who said something to the extent, I've got it in my notes here somewhere, but he said something to the extent of, this is just so patronizing. Only the premillennial view of eschatology provides a satisfactory climax. That was a funny word. That corresponds to the biblical.
I wrote an entire research paper on that word, by the way.
Oh, did you really?
Grad school's fun.
Grad school's great.
And Herman Melville is funny.
So anyway, he kind of goes on and on, but only the premillennial view. And I heard that and I just wanted to just be as dogmatic right back in the opposite direction and say something like, well,
right.
And that's not helpful at all.
Much like the tension between Arminianism and Calvinism.
Right, right.
Literal does not preclude symbolic and symbolic does not preclude literal.
Right.
There can be literal and symbolic dimensions to the same,
right.
Same description, the same story. And so, yeah, I think you can. I mean, I lean pretty heavily on the symbolic side. Personally.
Would you consider yourself an amillennialist?
Yeah.
But you're a postmillennialist.
Okay. So I haven't thought about it for a long time.
Okay.
Back when I did think about it for a brief period of time, and I did some fairly extensive reading, but it's been so long. I don't feel like I've given it the thought necessary to be able to defend a view, but I think I'm somewhat postmillennialist.
Okay.
In a qualified.
A qualified postmillennialist?
Way.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that...
But I'm not super confident about that. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. I know what I'm not more than what I know what I am.
That's where I am. I'm not a premillennialist.
I'm not premillennial dispensational.
Yeah. So I am.
There's some premillennial historical
not.
that's appealing to me. There's some amillennial that's appealing to me. There's some... there's some problems with postmillennial, but... I can see why I totally get
you can
why
see
you're
where
there.
Where yeah, I would yeah, be yeah, there yeah, yeah. yeah.
So
I think that verse 24 is pretty interesting. The nations will walk by God's light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it.
So this is cool because
there are kings. There are
yes, and so the cultural diversity will finally be celebrated in a way that there seems to be room in. The church
in the new earth
in the new earth in the expression of the church that the diverse things that we bring culturally across our world, across our races, across our whatever our experiences are, that those things will be significant, and that will, and that they will differ. And I think that's really, really exciting, that, that the African church and that the American church and that the
South American church
will all be able to contribute, and that it doesn't have to be identical. Not everything has to look like a white evangelical.
Like Jesus.
Right. You know. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So random song of the week. So you were saying that whole, whatever you were saying about, how many miles is it from here to the other side of the world? So this is a gal named Lisa LeBlanc, and this name of this song is 5,748 kilometers. And, it's a story song, and we don't have time for the whole thing, but it's pretty amazing. I should be saying something interesting right now while the guitar is playing.
I'm just swaying to the music. Getting down with my bad self.
It's fantastic. When she gets to it.
So let's get this straight. You're in Vancouver and I'm in New Brunswick. That makes 5,748 kilometers. We're talking two different oceans, four time zones apart. 7-hour plane ride plus connections. A 6-day drive. If you don't stop to pee too much, it's probably the dumbest idea that I've ever had. But I love you, yes, I really do.
I love it.
I like that.
If you don't stop to pee too much.
Lisa LeBlanc, 5,748.
Oh, my
kilometers.
Goodness. Well, great. Well, we had some.
And how far is that in freedom units?
In what?
Oh, I've never heard of this before. What are freedom units?
You know, imperial measurements that we Americans use and no one else in the world
right,
does.
Right, exactly.
Freedom units.
Oh, freedom units.
In miles? Is that
miles.
What you're trying to say? Well, a kilometer.
That was a weak joke.
10 kilometers is roughly 6 miles.
Okay, how many,
yes,
how many kilometers?
And 5 kilometers
talking?
Is roughly 3 miles. So if it's 5,000 and something, it's a little over 3,000 miles.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, anyway,
roughly.
I just wanted to say freedom units.
Yeah, which
yeah,
makes
that was
it
pretty great.
Which makes it roughly
how many kilometers did you say? 54 what?
5,748. Are you really doing this right now?
Are we doing
totally.
The math?
You are really doing this.
It's 3,500 miles.
There you go. Nice.
There you go.
That's like more than two Jerusalems. New Jerusalems.
End to end.
That's a little you know. Revelation joke for you.
Maybe I'll use that on Sunday.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness. We better wrap
oh
this thing up
gosh.
While we're still lucid. I don't know if we're lucid. Well, thanks for being with us this week, and we will be back at you next time. I'm David.
I'm Amanda.
Hopefully I'm still here next week after I get shot at by both sides.